You're listening to Catalyze, a podcast from the Morehead Cain Foundation at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm producer and host Caroline Leland. Today, you're going to hear from U.S. Representative Jim Cooper, Morehead Cain class of 1975. Born in Nashville, Tennessee, Jim represents the state's 5th district, which includes Nashville and surrounding areas. In Congress, he's known for his bipartisan work on the federal budget, health care, and government reform. When Congress is not in session, Jim teaches part-time at Vanderbilt. After Carolina, Jim won a Rhodes Scholarship to study at Oxford, where he earned a BA/MA in politics and economics. He also has a JD from Harvard Law School. Jim and his wife Martha, their 3 children, and various pets live in Nashville. In his free time, Jim enjoys spending time with his family, reading, and practicing his banjo.
My name is Jim Cooper. I'm the congressman for Tennessee's 5th Congressional District. I've been doing it for quite some time, and I'm a Morehead Scholar.
I know that you started serving as a U.S. representative in 1983, which was 3 years after you graduated from Harvard. So were you practicing law in those intervening years?
Well, I interned at various law firms, one in New York, one in Atlanta, and then in Nashville. I knew that to have a political future, I'd probably need to return to my home state. And really, I had only been practicing law for 9 months at this firm, Waller Lansdon, when I saw in the newspaper there was a brand new congressional district and that there was no incumbent. So I thought I'd have about as much chance to run as anyone. And I was very fortunate because a couple of miracles happened, even though I was only 27 at the time. I turned out to be the oldest candidate in the race. Even though I'd been out of state to fancy schools for much of my life, I'd gone to Tennessee for schools through 7th grade, and my opponent had never gone to school in Tennessee. My father having been governor, I thought that would be something someone could accuse me of coattailing on his reputation, but he had died years before. I had been governor before I was born, and my opponent's father was the then sitting U.S. Senate Majority Leader in the United States Senate. So I really couldn't be accused of coattailing when her father was one of the most powerful men then in America. So I was very fortunate, ended up with 67% of the vote. And that's a percentage I've pretty much held ever since. And that was nearly 40 years ago.
Yeah, that's really, really amazing. What was that first race like? Where, did you have any, even though you had these clear advantages over your opponent, did you have any self-doubt or were there any major challenges that you faced in your first campaign for public office?
Oh, huge self-doubt. I thought I'd have to practice law, say, for 20 years and then maybe be able to run for office. And then this opportunity came unexpectedly early. So, you know, luck favors the prepared. And I was pretty well prepared. For example, the joke in the campaign got to be that, you know, I hear Cooper's a Rhodes Scholar. It's about time we had somebody who knew something about the roads around here. And
that's funny.
Wildfire. But so much of politics is really luck and timing. And I just happened to be in the right place at the right time with the right opponent.
So it sounds like you have wanted to be in public office for a while. What draws you to this sphere of public service and public office?
My family taught me that public service was extremely important. You can't delegate these responsibilities. If you want a good country, you have to take on some of the responsibility yourself. And that feeling was confirmed in law school when I realized that politics is the profession of C students. And as an A student, I didn't want to spend my life interpreting laws written by C students. I thought it made a lot more sense to have maybe A students writing the laws. Also, you have to figure out if you have a chance to win. And even though I was extremely young back then, Tennessee's often favored fairly young candidates. Al Gore Jr. was pretty young when he ran. Harold Ford Jr. was pretty young when he ran. So it's a state that has looked kindly on young people. You know, the minimum constitutional age to run is 25, but Tennesseans have been open-minded about giving young people a chance.
Why do you think that is? Is there any particular reason?
Well, Tennessee is a moderate state. It's a border state from the Civil War days. They've tended to have to see both sides of an issue because half of our state sided with the North, the other half with the South. Also, we're pretty conservative in the sense that we pay our bills. We try to live within our means. We're not extravagant. Those sorts of thrifty virtues, I think, help build a strong culture in a state where hard work is expected, but it's also rewarded. You know, there's nothing like earned success. And so I think people respected the fact that I excelled at least in one sphere before and were willing to give me a chance. And I've been very fortunate that they've, with one notable exception, I've been willing to give me a chance ever since.
And I know that you mentioned paying bills, and I know that having a balanced budget is really important to you, which sometimes Democrats are accused of being less fiscally conservative. So could you talk about that, how you balance your political affiliations with your desires to keep a balanced budget, which everyone claims to do, but you're more conservative on the spending side?
Well, both political parties want to buy votes. Democrats have done that sometimes by writing taxpayer checks to beneficiaries. Republicans have often done it by handing out tax breaks, but it really amounts to the same thing. No one should buy votes. People should vote for candidates based on the quality of their beliefs, and nobody should try to offer free lunch because free lunches don't exist. I'm really worried about the future of the country. I think that there are many things to be worried about in and around the Trump administration, but as I say, both parties have gone along with spending future generations' money today. And the official debt isn't even accurately measured. Some people say $16 trillion, some people say $22 trillion, some people say $60 to $80 trillion. Bloomberg Businessweek even has it at $210 trillion. And remember, I'm saying trillion, that's T-R-I.
Right, which is like an incomprehensible number for the average human to process.
Understand that is to say that a million seconds is 12 days. A billion seconds is 32 years. A trillion seconds is 32,000 years. And the most conservative measures of our debt have it at 16 to 22 trillion. That's a fantastic amount of money. Most of that's accumulated just in the last 10 or 20 years. You know, the last president to pay off the debt entirely, which is probably too conservative, was Andrew Jackson. But that's really not the main problem. The main problem is many of the most important government programs are not even included in our totals. And it's irresponsible for politicians to claim they support those programs if they're not even budgeting for them. So this is not something really that students tend to focus on. When you get out in the real world, when you start paying taxes, pay your mortgage, make your car payment, you'll focus on this a lot more. And for some people, that's just an occasion to be depressed because the numbers are daunting. But if we don't take care of this, then we're shortchanging the future and we're really disadvantaging future generations. But it's not all gloom and doom. Christopher Buckley, the satiric novelist, wrote a book called A Boom's Day, which explains this in fairly cheerful terms. It's not as famous as his book, Thank You for Smoking, another hit in North Carolina, I'm sure.
Mm-hmm. I've heard of that one.
It's a way to wrap your mind around the problem.
Another element of your political history that I think stands out is your commitment to bipartisanship. I read that you were at one point ranked the 20th most bipartisan member of the House. Could you talk about sort of your thought process behind that and how you go about living out that commitment?
Well, I'm proud to be a Democrat and I love the Democratic Party, but not even it's always right. You know, my wife and I have been married 33 years, but not even she is always right. what really matters are results and the quality of an idea. So I don't believe that anybody or any party has a monopoly on wisdom. Sometimes good ideas, sometimes the best ideas come from unexpected places. So why not have listening ears and hear and benefit from those good ideas? One reason I worked so hard in school was to try to be able to measure ideas and to appreciate them. And life is too important. The future of our country and the world is too important to ignore dangers like climate change. There are many other issues that are vitally important for us to get a handle on and as early as possible. And remember, too, that political parties have often shifted their point of view. For example, when I was born in the 50s, the political party that was probably best on civil rights, on women's rights, and on the environment was, shockingly enough, the Republican Party. So oftentimes there are these slow reversals of party opinion. We're seeing a lot of rapid reversals now in the Trump administration because he's doing things that aren't even vaguely Republican. So loyal partisan Republicans are twisted in knots as they try to follow each tweet of the president because it's making no sense, at least in terms of party doctrine or philosophy. So I think if you're practical about this, you realize that we really don't even have a Congress anymore, because in a Congress, you're supposed to vote your conscience and your district. And that's all that Tip O'Neill asked of me when I first went to Congress. Today, you're expected to vote the party line all the time. And that's really not a Congress, that's a parliament. I believe that we should have a Congress again, and that people should weigh ideas on their merits and pick the best idea, regardless of authorship. So maybe that's an old-fashioned view, but I think that's the best way to honestly be bipartisan. Don't start with the prejudice that someone is your enemy. Listen to what they're saying and then decide if it makes any sense or not. That's a good way to, you know, I know I vote 80% plus of the time for the Democratic stuff, but I'm considered a dangerous maverick today when that used to be the norm just 20, 30 years ago.
Do you have any ideas or hope for how to make Congress less partisan?
Well, everyone in the House of Representatives has the title representative, and that's not a joke. That actually means they're supposed to represent their people back home. And sadly, many congressional districts are gerrymandered, and that means a majority of the people are either watching Fox TV at night or MSNBC. And both channels give you a distorted view of America. So I encourage people to switch their channels, or at least to get a discount on their TV if they buy it and they're only going to use one channel, because they need to be more open-minded and pay attention to what their neighbors think, what other people are thinking. I try to read the Wall Street Journal and the New York Times every day, as well as a local newspaper here in Nashville. That's a good way to hear different points of view, because unless you're constantly challenging yourself and constantly listening to new ideas, you're going to get locked in your own mindset and not be open to the exciting new things that are happening in the world today.
Right. I agree. When you look back at your political career so far, or your career in general, I should say, what stands out to you as the things that you're most proud of, whether that's accomplishments, other types of achievements?
Well, first of all, I'm one of the luckiest people in American history, not only to have gotten such an early start. I was the youngest congressman in America when I was elected, but also to have been able to serve this length of time and relatively few demands on my time for raising money or doing the silly political things that many of the folks have to do who want to achieve these offices. So I've been able to focus on substance, and that's a great luxury. So every day is an intellectual feast, which I'm trying to figure out, all right, what's the best thing for America to do today? Now, I don't have the power as one of 435 people to get my way all the time, but at least I'm able to influence the debate. It's amazing what you can do when you focus on it. I got a law passed called No Budget, No Pay. That's one of the least popular laws my colleagues have ever heard about. They hated it, but it became law because they realized it was necessary to do. This was in 2013. And it means that Congress will not get paid unless we do our work, unless we do our budgeting and appropriations. And that prevents government shutdowns. That prevents congressional silliness and not paying attention to our nation's finances. Now, the tragedy, my bill was permanent, but my friends who pushed the bill made it 1 year only. So it worked perfectly for that 1 year, but then it expired. This is an idea that they use in the New York and California legislature. Why Congress can't do it is a shame, but it would do more to get our nation back on track than any other single measure, and it became law. So it shows you that even what looks like a horribly unpopular idea at the time can end up happening and making a huge difference.
That is really impressive. Well, I know that when Congress is not in session, you teach at Vanderbilt, you're also a businessman and an attorney. Can you tell me about those activities? I'm curious, I don't actually know what you teach about and what's the business that you work on and what kind of law do you practice? I don't know about any of those activities.
Well, there are a couple of things I do on the side. One is I have the largest and best intern program on Capitol Hill. We have 40 or 50 interns a year. College students, and we put them through this sort of intellectual boot camp so that they can understand government and understand really how to learn. That's been an amazingly successful program, and we've had many Moreheads participate. I've also taught at Vanderbilt Business School for about 20 years. The course is on healthcare policy, understanding the most regulated industry in America. And it helps that Nashville is also a healthcare capital. Many of our firms here, some 500 different companies, are healthcare related companies, including some of the largest hospital companies in the world. So I'm very fortunate to have that background here and also to know a lot about the law and regulation that makes health policy. And I found that both teaching interns and teaching at Vanderbilt has helped keep me sharp because it forces you to keep up with current literature in a way that many of my colleagues do not. And to me, the excitement of life is to explore new ideas all the time and to understand what's really going on and to get many, many different points of view. And the academic environment is perfect for that. I think I probably learned that first and best at Chapel Hill because it's a major public university with a very diverse student population. You get a great cross-section, not only of North Carolina, a truly great state, but you also get, with the Morehead Cain program, you know, some of the best students anywhere in the country. So it's a marvelous experience that I think is really unduplicable. And that's a wonderful thing. And it's a great tribute to the university and to John Motley Morehead and Mr. Cain to have enabled so many students to go to Carolina who would not otherwise have gone.
And then you, do you also practice law?
No, under the congressional ethics rules, you're not allowed to make money on your own. There is an exception for teaching and for writing books, but that's about it.
Gotcha. We're almost out of time. I guess my last question, the last thing I really wanted to ask you about was, I read on your online that you play the banjo, and I wanted to know how long you've been doing that, and do you have any favorite songs?
Well, I love the five-string banjo. I have as a child. When I was 4 years old, my father's campaign bus, Earl Scruggs and Lester Flatt, were on the bus. So I thought that Earl Scruggs was like the Tin Man because he had metal fingers, because he had banjo picks on his fingers. The sound I've always found thrilling because it's so energetic. It's so amazingly fast. People really play faster than the ear can hear. And I've practiced for 30 plus years now. I'm still no good. I bought my first banjo at Carolina. It was a terrible banjo. The strings almost cut your fingers, but it got me started. And several banjos later, I'm still practicing. I still love bluegrass. And actually the new Steve Martin songbook is pretty amazing. He's got a couple albums out. And of course, he's a great humorist, but he's also a pretty darn good banjo player. And his songs are not pure bluegrass, but they're very accessible to an average sort of banjo player like me. But I really only play in private. I don't do this in public. It's a great instrument. And it's one of the few American-born instruments. You know, it's probably derived from instruments from Africa. But I've always heard the banjo and the saxophone are probably the only two real purely American instruments.
Well, is there anything else that you wish I had asked you about or anything else you wanted to say before we end?
Well, I don't want this to be a downer, but I'm really worried about the time of trouble at Carolina right now to have lost not only the head of the university, but also the head of the university system. I've really never encountered a period in which leadership was more needed. You know, when I was there, Bill Friday ran the university system as one of the most highly respected people in North Carolina or in American education. We always had excellent chancellors at Chapel Hill. So I'm worried that the divisiveness and the partisanship that's infected Washington is infecting a beloved state like North Carolina. So it's really sad. And to see this local election, congressional election overturned due to fraudulent activities, that's a stunning thing. So I think my main message would be young people shouldn't assume that progress is inevitable. Things don't always get better and better in the future. If you want things to get better, you have to participate and you have to make better things happen. So I love the activism of today's generation. I hope they'll be more active because we've never needed it more. And if we're going to keep America, you know, headed in the right direction.
You've been listening to Catalyze, a podcast from the Morehead Cain Foundation at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Thanks to Jim for telling us all about the life of a congressman. Thanks also to Creighton Irons, Morehead Cain Class of 2005, for our fantastic theme music. You can find more of Creighton's work at creightonirons.com. That's C-R-E-I-G-H-T-O-N-I-R-O-N-S.com. Next week, you'll hear from Danae Ringelman, Morehead King Class of 2000 and the co-founder of the industry-disrupting crowdfunding platform Indiegogo. If you like what you've been hearing on Catalyze, please tell your friends and then rate and review us on Apple Podcasts. That really helps other people find us. Thanks, as always, for listening.